Hello and welcome to a KABU Public Affairs special program, Focus on Iraq, 8 years of War, Prospects for Peace. I'm William Seaman, and with us for this discussion is political analyst and author Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam and directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. As an activist, writer, and analyst on Middle East and United Nations issues, she has provided insight and understanding on topics ranging from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the conflict in Israel-Palestine to the role and workings of the United Nations and the current wave of people power pro-democracy protests sweeping through the Middle East and North Africa. Phyllis Bennis, thanks for joining us this morning.
Great to be with you.
As we approach the 8th anniversary of the U.S. war in Iraq on March 19th, it's hard not to feel that this conflict has somehow simply disappeared. We had reports in August, of course, announcing that the last U.S. combat brigades had left the country, leaving 50,000 so-called non-combat troops there. And it certainly seemed to mark an end to the U.S. war. Since then, any discussions of war have been typically of Afghanistan. Phyllis Bennis, where does the U.S. war in Iraq stand today? And will the Obama administration's withdrawal plan mean a genuine end to the U.S. war in Iraq?
Well, I think it's very important to understand that the war in Iraq continues. The role, the exact role of U.S. troops has been changing, but there are still 50,000 U.S. troops still occupying the country. The majority of them are combat troops. They have been given new names. Their brigades have been changed from combat brigades to so-called training brigades. But these, we should make no mistake about it, these are combat troops that remain in Iraq. The Obama administration so far is saying that they intend to abide by the letter of the agreement signed between the U.S.-backed and U.S.-controlled government in Iraq and the U.S. government in the last weeks of the Bush administration, which called for all U.S. troops and all Pentagon-paid mercenaries to be out of Iraq by the end of this year. And so far, President Obama says he plans to abide by that. There are two key things, though, that we have to keep our eye on, even assuming that those words are absolutely true. The first is that the possibility is very strong that with a little bit of U.S. urging, shall we say, the government of Maliki in Baghdad, which of course is still completely dependent on the United States, will agree to renegotiate the terms of the agreement. That's a definite possibility. It would probably happen at the very last minute. It probably would not involve the Iraqi parliament, where anti-occupation sentiment is very, very strong. And if it happens, I think it would happen at a very last-minute basis without discussion either in the U.S. Congress or the Iraqi parliament. Would be a decision made at the executive level in both capitals and would then be announced as a fait accompli. That's a serious danger. The other more certain danger is that the terms of the SOFA agreement are quite specific in what needs to be excluded, what needs to be withdrawn. So it says that all, it doesn't say mercenaries, but it says all private military contractors who are being paid by the Pentagon must be withdrawn. It does not say all U.S.-paid mercenaries. So what we're seeing already, and we saw this just a few days ago when Secretary of Defense Robert Gates appeared to in Congress to testify about the need for new money for the State Department, not for his own department. But the goal is to keep those mercenaries on track, keep the work being done, but pay them by the State Department rather than the Pentagon, which would technically be within the letter of the law of that agreement. So you have this weird scenario of the Secretary of Defense, according to the headline in the Washington Post, saying, quote, Gates pleads for funding to keep Iraq work going. And the subhead says, without it, he says, State Department can't take over from troops. And you want to say to yourself, wait a minute, since when does the State Department take over from troops? The State Department is supposed to be about diplomacy. But what we're seeing in Iraq is the complete militarization of diplomacy in the interests of maintaining a war that is theoretically supposed to end by the end of this year.
And again, what are the numbers of these contractors, these mercenaries that we're talking about that are going to continue to be a presence in Iraq?
Well, it's not clear. There will be tens of thousands that will be involved. We don't know the exact number, but the funds are, there could be, I mean, there have been different numbers floated around. There's talk of 5,000 U.S. officials who would be part of the U.S. embassy in Iraq, the embassy, of course, being now the largest U.S. embassy in the world. So far, there's a $5.2 billion allocation for next year, and the question is whether that will be approved. That was what, part of the reason why Gates was coming to plead for that. $5.2 billion is far less, of course, than the $100 billion or so average that the war has cost this last couple of years. So the numbers are going to be smaller. I think what is clear is that the nature of the war is changing, but the U.S. involvement in the war is not over. The U.S. is not carrying out the bulk of the combat. The U.S. is not involved in major attacks at this point and have not been for some months. But they are still there, and when attacked, they do fight back. That would continue to be the case with State Department-paid contractors, whether they're from Blackwater or any of the other military contracting agencies. They would have even less accountability to the U.S. than U.S. troops would.
As I said earlier, the reports in August set the troop level at about 50,000 U.S. troops. And as you say, these are not necessarily non-combat troops. These are combat troops as well. But has there been any indication in terms of those troop levels that the Obama administration is indeed moving towards drawing down those numbers significantly as we approach this date of the end of the official end of U.S. involvement?
No, it's been at about between 49 and 50,000 for some months now. I don't anticipate that we're going to see a gradual withdrawal. I think we'll see it kind of in a more dramatic way, not least because I think President Obama wants to get credit for that withdrawal. So I don't think it'll happen until the fall, and it'll be more likely in larger numbers.
Is it reasonable to interpret this? Certainly, this seems to be an interpretation in the more the commercial media, that this has become a manageable conflict, a kind of a cold war for the United States that policymakers consider essentially a success for them.
Well, I think that's the hope. I'm not sure it's the reality yet. It's what they're hoping will be the case. The bottom line for a war like this is that as long as it stays off the front pages, it can be deemed a success. That means, one, no U.S. casualties, and two, no massive mass casualty situations that would end up on the front pages, even if there were no American lives involved. It doesn't mean that the situation in Iraq is getting any better. I mean, the irony is, of course, in this moment of extraordinary democratic risings across the Middle East, Iraq has not been immune from that. Surprisingly, in some ways, the demands of protesters that have been in the streets in cities across Iraq in recent weeks has not been for the overthrow of the government, but rather simply calls for reform, for more access to jobs and electricity, and to an end to corruption. Those demonstrations have been met with brutal force. Just about a week ago, in just one protest in one city, 29 civilian protesters were gunned down by this U.S.-backed government in Iraq. We've heard very little about that relative to what we've heard about civilian casualties in Libya and other places. But that's something that's ongoing at this point. And I think that the reality is for Iraqis, the war continues. I think that there is a sense that the war is very much at the root of the economic problems that have led to such massive unemployment that's been the case for 8 years now, the inability of the government to provide even the basics of clean water and electricity on a consistent basis, and this for a country that was, for many years, despite enormous repression during the years of Saddam Hussein's regime, was very advanced on the side of economic and social rights, where things like electricity and clean water were taken for granted, much as we do here in the United States. It's been 8 years, and there is still only a few hours a day of reliable electricity in most of the country. So those realities are very, very stark. There also is continuing violence throughout the country. Some of it sectarian, some of it power-driven, And Iraq remains a very war-torn country. It is not yet a post-war country.
Again, we're talking with Middle East policy analyst, author, and activist Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. Ms. Bennis, there are protests coming up here in Portland, and I think in other parts of the country, peace rallies and marches here in Portland. It's on March 19th. Folks can visit the Portland Peaceful Response Coalition website at pprc-news.org if you want details about that action. That's, again, on March 19th, Saturday, at Pioneer Courthouse Square, downtown Portland. Ms. Bennis, do you think demonstrations like this do any good? I mean, what's the role of protest? We've been watching these phenomenal explosions of pro-democracy protest and demonstration throughout the Middle East. What's the role of these kinds of public expressions of dissent here in the United States? And are they an important part of changing the policy?
I think protest is a huge part of changing the policy and of showing how the policy has already changed. I think that we have to be very clear that protest is not only about going into the streets. A demonstration can demonstrate many things. It can demonstrate strength. It can also demonstrate weakness. So I think we have to be very clear. Street protests are a tactic that are sometimes appropriate, sometimes not. Protest is a strategy. The question is what kind of protest. For example, sometimes street protests are exactly what's needed. Other times, things like campaigns aimed at alternative centers of power, looking at, for example, city council resolutions, demanding that the money be brought home. You know, look at what's happening today, for example, in Wisconsin. You have these enormous demonstrations in Wisconsin that are transforming the politics of that state and of the country as a whole on the question of the economic crisis. Well, let's look at the links. The budget deficit in Wisconsin this year is $1.8 billion. It turns out that just this year, the people of Wisconsin will pay $1.7 billion, almost the exact same amount, in tax money for their share of the war in Afghanistan. That's not even including their share of the Pentagon budget or their share of the war in Iraq. Just for Afghanistan, $1.7 billion just from Wisconsin taxpayers. I don't think most people in Wisconsin know that. I think the same is true in Oregon and in every other part of the country. So part of what we need to be doing is working with the unions that are demanding that they not be made to pay the whole price, family organizations, community organizations who are struggling with the economy. It's there where the costs of war here come home. And I think much of our work needs to be focused on building those kinds of alliances.
You've talked a little bit about the expenses of these wars. In a recent article you published in December, you mentioned the 2010 military budget combined with the cost of Iraq and Afghanistan wars, that cost was on the order of $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit in a more... It's quite staggering. In terms of Iraq, you've also mentioned that the costs are going down. What are we talking about in terms of, say, the current costs, but perhaps the projected cost if plans unfold as they seem to be in terms of U.S. policy in Iraq?
Well, I don't have the most recent figures right now. They're being brought down even further in the budget negotiations in the Congress, but there's no question that there are tens of billions of dollars, about $68 billion this year for Iraq. It will be substantially less next year because the cost of a smaller State Department-led program for training and that sort of thing is much less than keeping tens of thousands, 50,000 as we have now, occupation troops in the country. The numbers are much smaller, and because the focus will be on support in the form of training, military equipment, arms, etc., to the Iraqi government, it won't be the same as a 50,000-strong occupation force, and it won't cost as much. The costs are escalating rapidly in Afghanistan as they go down in Iraq. So the costs of U.S. wars and the possibility that there might be another if the U.S. chooses to go ahead with a plan for a so-called no-fly zone in Libya that could rapidly escalate into a much greater military engagement, we are paying an enormous amount for wars in this country that are not making us safer, that are all illegitimate and many of them illegal, and that are not having any good benefit for the people of those countries. Instead, it's the reason that we don't have money for jobs, for health care, for schools, for infrastructure repair here at home. And that's the link that I think becomes critical.
Well, as you've mentioned, both just now, but also in that December article with Kevin Martin, you describe this need to build alliances with the key movements rising in response to the economic crisis, movements fighting for immigrant, labor, community, and civil rights. Now, that seems to suggest that mobilizations against the wars need to broaden the focus of their actions to include these other struggles. Or do you have something else in mind? I know.
Yeah, I have something a little bit differently in mind, and that is that anti-war activists need to bring that information, the costs of war, et cetera, to the work of those other organizations, not asking them to come to us. This is no longer a moment, as it was during the 8 years of the Bush administration, when the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were the cutting edge of the Bush policy, if you will. They were the cutting edge of how people understood what George Bush stood for. The war in Afghanistan, despite the fact that it has escalated under Obama, is not seen as the cutting edge issue facing people in this country. And any good organizer knows that you don't start with where you want people to be, you start with where they are. And where people are in this country is hurting. People are hurting economically, they're not able to get jobs, they're losing their houses. And so for most people, when you say, well, I want you to come to an anti-war demonstration, they don't have time for that. When we bring to a mobilization demanding that money be spent on maintaining the social welfare network and expanding it rather than cutting it at this moment when people are hurting so badly, and we come to that and say, there's a reason for this. There's a reason, and the reason is we're spending $1 trillion on wars and the Pentagon instead of on jobs and rebuilding and homes and schools and education. That's when I think people hear things differently. That's when they start demanding different things of their members of Congress, of their city councils, of their state assemblies. That's when we start to change the dynamic that we now see, where there is, for example, 72% of the people in this country want a rapid end to the war in Afghanistan, not waiting until 2014, as President Obama has threatened. But that's not what's operative in the Congress. There still is a view in Congress that somehow you're going to pay a big price politically if you don't support the war. And what we need to do is change that relationship so that the understanding is that there's a big price to pay if you don't oppose the war. And I think that by bringing the anti-war message, the cost of war message, the demand to move our money away from war and towards jobs and rebuilding a green economy in this country, that's what's going to make that possible. Not having more anti-war demonstrations and hoping that other people show up. It's being part of these broader movements that are on the rise. That's where we need to have anti-war messages.
Well, and one would imagine also when one is mobilizing on an anti-war topic that you're also trying to address these key issues of these other communities. So,
absolutely.
So, for example, Veterans for Peace has started this campaign, which is a part of the local mobilization, of basically posing the question, how is the war economy working for you?
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, the tension, of course, is that whenever you introduce concerns of the broader community, say, for example, immigrant rights, that, you know, this is a part of our community that has been targeted in recent mm-hmm. years, or labor rights, or another issue that you've been very involved in, the issue of Israel-Palestine, the conflict there, there is a tension that arises in terms of, no, we need to stay focused on the war. How do you try to resolve that tension?
I try to stay focused on the goals. The goals are to end the war. The question is, how do we do that? Being narrow in our focus and saying the only issue is the impact on Afghans, the impact on Iraqis, on a moral basis, that's an absolutely defensible position. But it doesn't work to end the war. If the goal is to end the war, it has to be part of the broader political debate that is actually engaging people in this country, not part of the debate that we wish people were engaged in. So that's not a problem. For me, the issue is, what's the best way of moving towards something that can win? that can bring an end to these wars? How do we change the policy? We've gotten a little better recently at figuring out how to change the discourse. That's a preliminary obligation, and it's something that has to happen first. But it's not enough, and we haven't yet figured out very well how to change the policy. So doing what we've always done and thinking it's somehow going to work better, I don't think is going to work, in fact. I think we have to work differently. These wars are the same. The wars are the same or worse than they were under Bush. But the political environment in which we're fighting those wars is qualitatively different. And if we don't recognize that, it's not going to work to think we're going to end the war by doing the same thing we did during the Bush years. It's just a different political moment. People are facing an economic crisis. The cost of wars is more overt now than it used to be, but it doesn't mean that people make those links. So I think that that's, in many ways, the new obligation, if you will, of longtime anti-war forces who have fought these wars since before they began. There's, you know, a whole generation of people who have grown up fighting the so-called global war on terror, fighting against that war. And we haven't won yet. It's a long war, and it's a big anti-war movement, and we have a lot of work to do. But a big chunk of that is bringing our message to other communities, other organizations that are rising. The cost of war, I think, is the issue that has the best chance of leading to an end to those wars in this period.
You know, you're mentioning young people. It's hard to believe that there are young folks in college today who were barely 10 years old when the U.S. started these wars.
Exactly.
How do you approach this? How should an aging anti-war community be approaching the younger generation who've grown up with these wars?
Well, I think the same way that we have with older people. Part of it is to talk about the price they pay. That in this era, in this moment of economic crisis where so few people have access to higher education, too many people are being forced, drafted, if you will, into the military because that appears to be the only option they have. So the anti-war movement needs to be working with youth organizations that are trying to find jobs for young people, for example. Counter-recruitment becomes a very important component of what we do, that we make clear to people. The Iraq Veterans Against the War, for instance, has a what they call not counter-recruitment, but a truth in recruitment campaign based on the idea that young people are fed lies by the military to convince them to come join the military. And at a time when people really can't get jobs, that part's not a lie. That part's true. The military starts to look like a better option. So working with organizations that are looking for job opportunities for young people becomes a very important part of our anti-war work.
And we've been talking with Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author of Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer. Ms. Bennis, any closing thoughts for our listeners today?
This war has been going on for a really long time, and I think that a lot of us have been trying very hard to figure out how to keep fighting it without burning out, and it's hard. It's really hard. And I think the way to do it is to look at the exciting things that are happening in this country, to look at what's happening now not only in Wisconsin but Ohio and Indiana and other places where people are rising, people are in the streets, the unions are back in the streets saying this is not acceptable. And that's where we're hearing the most openness, the most excitement about the idea that, oh yeah, there's a reason. Beyond the broadly defined economic crisis, there's a reason we don't have enough money for jobs, and that reason is war. We can't afford it. And I think that by fighting on those terms, it doesn't mean that we're abandoning the moral demand on all of us as individuals to stand up for the civilian populations of Iraq and Afghanistan and Palestine who are paying the ultimate price for U.S. policy, directly or indirectly. That remains part of what we do. But there's another thing that we need to do, which is to reach people in this country in a whole new way. That's already underway. Organizations like the New Priorities Project, the National Priorities Project, all of these are organizations that are looking at the realities of war and saying, how does that war come home? And how do we move the money to make the war impossible and at the same time begin to rebuild lives here? I think it's a great moment and a great opportunity.
Phyllis Bennis, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in to KABU Public Affairs special program featuring author, activist, and Middle East analyst Phyllis Bennis. I'm William Seaman. Thanks for tuning in.
Just to remind folks once again, on Saturday, March 19th, at 12:30 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in downtown Portland, marking 8 years of the war in Iraq, over 9 years of the war in Afghanistan, a mobilization for peace, calling for an end to the wars and occupations, calling for bringing the troops home now. Over 50 community organizations are co-sponsoring or endorsing this peace rally and march. KABU is a proud co-sponsor for this action as well. To find out more, you can call Peace and Justice Works here in Portland at 503-236-3065. That's 503-236-3065. Or you can visit the Portland Peaceful Response Coalition website. That's at www.pprc-news.org. Or just search for Portland Peaceful Response Coalition in your favorite search engine. And you can also find an event page for the mobilization on Facebook. You can find a link to that event page on the PPRC website. You can help spread the word by sharing the event with your friends if you're on Facebook. But however you find out and however you choose to tell other folks about this actions, mark your calendar. It's Saturday, March 19th, Pioneer Courthouse Square. 12:30 p.m. there'll be music, 1 p.m. rally, and 1:30 p.m. a peace march through downtown Portland. We hope to see you out there.